Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, once again speaking from his little writing corner on the navigation deck in Andalusia. It's the early hours of the morning, pre-dawn hours, of the Cinco de Mayo. I believe that's the Mexican national holiday, 5th of May 2013, and this is nav briefing number 63, the Gnostic Moment. So here I am with the cats. They're flopped out on the bed, sleeping comfortably as they do usually this time of the morning. And outside toward the east, I can see the Sunrise Crescent, indicating the completion phase of the Chinamasta shift, or the Mirita shift, as it may be called. So this is the second night of a four-night vigil I'm making, as I have sometimes the habit of doing. Tertons are known, or they will have been known, in Gaian planetary folklore, for observing some of their more profound and delicate operations of shamanism during the period of the dark of the moon, the darkening moon. And so I'm awaiting the sunrise crescent this morning, and I will again tomorrow morning and after that. And I think after Tuesday morning, I won't be able to see it again. That will probably be the last glimpse before it disappears entirely into the orb of the sun to reappear then around, let's see what it would be. It'll reappear around the 11th of May, and that will be the sunset crescent in the bull, indicating the beginning of the shift overseen by Bhudevi and the wrathful green Tara, who is known as the Selector. So such are the wonderful parameters of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. I know that some of you follow them avidly, some of you less avidly. It's appropriate that you all follow your own talents and inclinations and do what you enjoy, that's all. It's my role to provide, from time to time, an updated report, or better said, some updated intel on the Dakini shifts so that I can reinforce what you already know and confer to you a little more confidence in learning how to detect and transceive these cycles of subliminal mind transmission. So one of the wonderful aspects of this experiment and of planetary tantra in general is how we are continually learning, and how the learning is cumulative, and it's an enhanced learning. You're in an enhanced learning process, and each enhancement of it brings you more and more into the center of your own innate genius as a human animal. We are the magical animals of the goddess. We have each in us a genius, a particular formulation of genius, I would even say, which can be read in the stars and read from the star-based genotype. And planetary tantra and the practices of the GNE nurture that genius in you, which is an intuitive, imaginative capacity grounded in the heart of your mind and the mind of your heart. So it's a great pleasure for me to be a teacher of this fine art of Gaian Tantra. And as you know, I teach what I'm in the process of learning. And right now, what I'm in the process of learning exceeds anything that I've learned before. I would say that since I came out of the Dhumavati event, I've been operating on a level that's approaching the equivalent mania to the mania of 2008 when I received the term of Gaia Awakening. I mean, things are really moving around here. For me to maintain a download capacity of 100 to 60 is pretty ferocious. I mean, that is a very high velocity download capacity. I would say that the majority of my NAV briefings up until now have been in the range of 100 to 40 download capacity, and maybe a 40 to 40 delivery, a 40 to 30 delivery capacity, that is to say, delivering at 3/4 of the rate of transception. But what's happening now is just going off the charts. I can transceive comfortably now at 100 to 60 download. And I can assure you that 180 download, 100 to 80 download, is about as far as a human being can handle. Beyond 100 to 80 download, you get into 100 to 85, 100 to 95 download ratio, and you can't see. It's the velocity and brilliance of the download is like a cascade of liquid diamond. It's obliteratingly beautiful, and it's blinding. I mean, you really can't see anything. It's a strange experience to be standing normal, totally awake, all the senses operating, to be standing on a hill somewhere in Spain, looking at the sky, looking at the clouds, looking at the oak and the carob trees, in a state of ecstatic trance. And when the download ratio goes above 100 to 80, you can't really see anything. I mean, you just stand there, and I suppose someone who would observe me in that state would just see a man standing there on a hill with his eyes open, standing quite still. And above 100 to 80 ratio, the mind literally turns into a sheet of liquid diamond. And you read in the glitter of that diamond as it flows through your mind, that diamond rush generates a glitter, and you read in that glitter the Dakini intel, and everything that you read is completely perfect and lucid, and you understand it 1,000%. You know exactly what you're seeing, but it comes so fast that you can't retain it or remember it. So what happens is that the body retains it. The Dakini is the memory of the body. This is a wonderful saying from the Hivajra Tantra. The Dakini is the memory of the body. So the Dakini is not only the atmospheric agency of the subliminal input of enlightened, non-elaborated thought into your mind, but the Dakini is also the repository that remembers that input. And it is a bodily repository. So you go away with the zip file of what you have downloaded or transceived. And then later you unzip it and pull it out of the body, because the Dakini is the memory of the body. But at the moment that you're in something like 100 to 80, 100 to 90 download ratio, you can't remember anything. You don't have time to remember. And yet everything is lucidly clear. This is called cognitive samadhi, or sabija samadhi. I think if you go back to the yogic writings of Patanjali or some of those people like that, you'll find the description of two kinds of samadhi or cosmic consciousness, which are called nirbija, meaning without seed, and sabija, with seed. Bija is a Sanskrit word for seed, meaning cognition, thought. Every thought is a seed. So you can have total and complete cosmic consciousness in ecstatic trance with seed or without seed. You can have it with a cognitive content or without a cognitive content. So I'm talking about, when I speak of a 100 to 80 plus download ratio, I'm talking about sabija samadhi, and that is a cognitive ecstasy. And it is an ecstasy that contains thought, but the thought is non-elaborated. The difference is very simple. If you sit now, or just wherever you are, sitting somewhere, and just look around, look out the window, and wait and let your mind form a thought, and say it forms the thought, that was a nice sailboat that I saw when I was walking on the beach yesterday. You know, that's a thought. You can elaborate that thought. You can say, oh, I was on another sailboat, or oh, the sand under my feet was crunching when I saw it. You can elaborate around that thought. And that is the nature of most ordinary thinking. Most ordinary thinking is loose, is of a loose weave. And so you can pull on the weave of the thought, and you can elaborate it and twist it. So that's what people do when they write journals. That's what people do when they write novels. When they revise things that they write, they're elaborating their thought. What comes as you ascend the through degrees of transception from 100 to 40 to 100 to 50, 60, up to 100 to 80 and beyond, is that you shift, your attention shifts out of thought that can be elaborated into non-elaborated thought. You continue to have thought, but it is thought that cannot possibly be any further developed than it is. It is thought that is in the condition of a crystalline nectar, of a distillation to absolute perfection of clarity. And this is a real physical experience. And at these moments, such as the one transpiring right now, the moment of completion of a Dakini shift, the Gayan sorcerer takes advantage of particular conditions of downloading at a high velocity, a high ratio of download transmission, and combined with a high capacity of body storage. Because in the completion of a Dakini shift, you have that advantage. That's why it's called completion. It means the storage of subliminal intel in the body, in the cellular and neurochemical repository of the body, in the entire body. You don't store it in your head. You don't store it in your brain. You store it in your entire body. And the conditions for doing this are ideal during the last 5 days of any Dakini shift. Now, where do I start on this briefing number 63, talking about the Gnostic moment? Well, my friends, me metis, me pals of past, present, and future, me tantrikas and kalika warriors, we are now in the Gnostic moment. In fact, the entire world, whether it knows it or not, is now in the Gnostic moment. The Gnostic moment is a time, a fortunate time, or what the old Greek initiates called a kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S, a fortunate moment for the human race and every single human animal. And the fortunate moment is signaled by the transit of the apogee of the moon across the horns of the bull and into the feet of the twins. And as the apogee of the moon enters the twins, we on this planet enter the Gnostic moment. So that's to be the subject of this talk. Before I get into the thick of it, I will say, I will make a comment on the obvious, which is that in planetary tantra, you don't suffer at all. There is no suffering, and we don't glorify suffering. But there is a kind of affliction that comes with the process or the practice, and that is due to the abundance of riches. I think that many of you would agree on that. So as usual, we have an abundance of riches going into the Gnostic moment. Look at what was introduced at the end of the last talk. The grand and perplexing theme of reincarnation now becomes a motif of the GNE. So we have reincarnation floating in the wind, in the trade winds, in the transaction winds. I have only devoted one talk so far to the symbiont. There is more about the spell of the symbiont. So the odor of the symbiont and the odor of Pan is floating in the transaction winds. And, of course, we still have the Kalika War Party forming. We have the Matangi Eye running. Got your mojo running, and keep your Matangi Eye and your mojo running together. That's a formula for happiness and success. Some of you out there know who I'm talking to. You islanders. And, of course, Mephisto is always lurking somewhere around in the corridors. And we observe Mephisto rules operating in the world, adding to the mass of confusion that is already afflicting the human animal. Remember that Mephisto rules can be detected in a number of ways, but primarily and quite consistently, you can detect Mephisto rules operating when people do things and follow rules and procedures without knowing why or who introduced those rules and procedures. For instance, political correctness is a blatant and disgusting manifestation of Mephisto rules. And political correctness is extremely important for Mephisto because Mephisto is the magician, as it were, the trickster, who represents the supernatural element that keeps the false narrative running on this planet. So the false narrative about humanity and about history and about current events, the false narrative that is propagated every day in the media, 724, is a huge fabric of lies. And in order to keep this narrative up and running, Mephisto has to be throwing magic dust in everyone's eyes and spreading his lies and enforcing his lies constantly. So Mephisto represents that elusive supernatural factor inside the narrative that compels people to collude with the narrative and compels them to tell lies and to spread lies, either advertently or inadvertently, you see. So Mephisto has a wonderful skill for drawing human animals into collusion with his lies. And one of the tools that ensures that collusion is political correctness. Another tool is the factor of the refusal of arrogation. Arrogation happens when someone stands up and asks someone a question. When they question the narrative or question any kind of statement, that's arrogation. Arrogation, by the way, is a powerful tool of Matangi for social confrontation. And I would like to say more about that and specifically about how to deploy the tool of arrogation in the third year of these initial conditions. You know, Luke Radowski is probably the best known, the founder of We Are Change. It goes around, this young man in his 20s who goes around and confronts people like Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski and people like this, and he arrogates to them. He asks them what they don't want to be asked. And of course, it's very brave of him to do that, and it's a powerful act, a warrior's act, but of course he never gets any answer because according to Mephisto rules, you refuse arrogation. So all politicians, all governors of states, or the governor of New York City who's giving a news conference, or the governor of the mayor of Boston who's giving a news conference, refuses arrogation. That is, he follows Mephisto rules. But why does he refuse arrogation? He doesn't even know. He does, in a way, he has in his mind an idea. He has a rationalization. But if you were to pick apart his rationalization for refusing the arrogation of some direct and honest person who put a real question to him, it would all, the texture and the fabric of that rationalization would just fall apart like rotten tissue. And then there is some irreducible factor of irrationality that compels collusion in the great lie, and that is Mephisto. And Mephisto rules are the rules that by which that complicity maintains itself. So we are always considering these matters. These are wonderful tools of discernment that come along with the practice of the GNE. And there are many, many other things floating around in the air. I have a little sketch here of the 60s series of briefings, and I will be touching on the Aeon Christos and the Christic Intercession. I'll be giving a recap of that in the next briefing, probably, and linking it then to the legend of Eros and Psyche, and in turn linking it to Pan and the symbiont. So that's coming up. Digression on Socrates coming up. Psyche's method coming up. Pandemonia coming up. Oh, what a word. What a word, you know. This is the word. I mean, does a mothership have lifeboats? This is a good question, you know. You know, big ships, these big sailing vessels, they all have lifeboats, right? They're huge in themselves. They have to have 50 to 100 people in a lifeboat, you know. Are there any lifeboats on the mothership? Well, I don't know, but if there are, they would have the word pandemonium written on the side of them. So this is where it is today, this morning at dawn, and I'm going to go out now and spend some time gazing at the crescent, after which I'll return for the rest of this briefing. The sunrise crescent of the Merida shift currently stands just below the nose of the whale that is swimming toward the Manitou, swimming toward the urn held on the right side of the Manitou. And in the next 2 days, as I do this visual, the increasingly diminishing lunar crescent will slide gently through the constellation of the Fishes until it arrives at an exact alignment with the Andromeda Galaxy a few hours before the exact end of this shift. So I just stepped out there and was looking up at the moon, and about 30 seconds after I got out there, there was something exploded just beneath the moon. Something in the sky exploded. It wasn't a meteor. It didn't leave a meteor trail. It was just a flash, very white and quite large as, say, the star Aldebaran. So some object in the sky, some object perhaps orbiting around the Earth, just blew up in front of my eyes. And I've seen that before, and it always seems to be in that direction, strangely, toward the southeast. I've seen what appear to be large vessels of some kind, large crafts just blowing up and incinerating up there. Oh, well, who knows what's going on? There's so much secrecy on this planet, which is, of course, one of the great problems that humanity must overcome as the wisdom goddess achieves her correction. No secrecy. End of secrecy. The end of secrecy is a teaching of Bhairavi, by the way. So, as I was saying, there are a lot of things floating around here on deck. Some of the things that are not in the holes or stowed away are stored on deck, and they tend to move around and shift around, and these are the themes and inspirations that come up as this experiment proceeds. What I'd like to talk about right now is the picture of the lunar apogee at this exact moment and in the immediate time to come. Let's recall that in the course of the 3 years of the GNE, there are three great lessons to learn posed by the celestial writing. The first is the lesson of the ram or bodhisattva confronting the satanic head of Cetus. And this is about a lesson about the ultimate threat to this experiment, this divine experiment, and about the masks of evil that are worn by the satanic power of Cetus. The second lesson is drawn from the bull, and currently now, right now, we are just completing that lesson. What a magnificent lesson. It concerns the power of the two polarities of divine imagination and the third force represented by the eye of the bull. Now, as the lunar apogee moves into the twins, comes the phase over into the third lesson. Third lesson is displayed by the constellation of the twins, associated with the Hindu Mahavidya known as Bagalamukhi, but in the GNE, it's advisable to use the term Idris and to call her by the name Idris, which is a powerful name drawn from Islamic culture, a name of a witch, Iblis, Idris. Idris is also a name from the Celtic and Welsh lore. In fact, there is a powerful seat of witchcraft in Wales known as Cader Idris, or the seat of Idris, the witch. Idris is the mistress of fate, and Idris has some momentous lessons for humanity in the coming year. You know, your position as the crew member in the GNE puts you at the front of the class of humanity. You in this experiment are learning things that human generations will learn in the future. Generations will learn what you are learning now, and they will also learn from what you are learning now. You're sitting at the head of the class. You're in the avant-garde. And the lessons that Idris has to impart about fate, let me tell you, I don't want to build up any false expectations, but you won't be disappointed. I was saying to a couple who visited me yesterday, and that's a rare occasion that I get a physical visit, I was saying that the lessons to be learned in the third year of this experiment take human intelligence and imagination to its uttermost limits. If you think we're out there contemplating the bull, the power of the bull, the AC and DC currents of the horns, the central current, a phylogenetic narrative, if you think that's out there, just wait until you see what comes from Idris. The highest forms of planetary tantra come in the instruction of Idris and Tantra Mother, that is to say, the accompanying constellation of the crab. So, quite exciting to look forward to that. And that has something to do with being in the Gnostic moment, obviously. So how do I define the Gnostic moment? Well, it's quite simple. If I move over here to where I have all of my charts laid out, and I find the page that has the list of apogee and perigee surges, then looking at that list, I can offer you an overview of the pattern, a celestial pattern involving the lunar apogee. So at the beginning of the year 2013, as we entered into this year, the lunar apogee was at the eye of the bull. The apogee, that is, the far point of the moon. And Jupiter itself, which was retrograde at that time, was about 3 degrees from there. So that if you put the apogee in proximity to Jupiter and you give it a margin of 3 or 4 degrees, you can call that a converge. So they were in converge. Jupiter was within 3 degrees of the apogee. Then as you moved on to the end of January, the lunar apogee began to move ahead, because on the overall of its overall annual rate, without variations, its mean rate, the lunar apogee tends to move forward through the zodiac a little bit more rapidly than Jupiter. It makes a complete cycle of the zodiac in about 8.5 years, whereas it takes Jupiter almost 12 years. So you see, the velocity of the lunar apogee is a little faster. So the lunar apogee begin to pull away from Jupiter in January. And by the time we come to the middle of February, it has reached 16 Gemini, which is beyond the forehead of the bull. The lunar apogee is now between the two horns. It is, as it were, transacting a circuit between the AC and the DC currents and carrying forward the central or third force current. Then we, and at that time, Jupiter is still hovering around Aldebaran. Because remember, there is a Jupiter retrograde period. Then as we come forward into the month of March, we find that toward the end of March, the lunar apogee has advanced almost to the horn tips of the bull. It's advanced to that space between the two horn tips, because that is like a gateway. It's a gateway into the constellation of the twins. And when the planets come through the zodiac in their natural order, whether it be Mercury or Venus or Jupiter or Mars or Saturn or the moon, they pass through the open gateway between the two horns generally. And so that's where you find the lunar apogee reaching toward the end of March. And that is, of course, approaching the Crab Nebula, which is near the tip of the southern horn. And by that time, in March, Jupiter has now come out of its retrograde phase. It is exactly conjunct Aldebaran, and it is advancing, starting to follow the apogee. Then we come down to the 15th of April, and that was the last apogee surge. At that time, the apogee was at 28 Gemini, which is in conjunction with the Crab Nebula, and Jupiter had moved to 15 Gemini. Now, you understand, when I say Gemini, it's shorthand for the equal 30-degree sectors of the ecliptic. It's not the constellation of the twins. You have to use the scale of the 12 equal signs, which are 30-degree sections of the ecliptic, to locate something, but you know at the same time that you're locating it in the constellations. So, Jupiter at 15 Gemini, again, has just starting to surpass the forehead of the bull and just starting to move toward that passageway between the two horns. Now, that was Monday, the 15th of April, and as I pointed out, that day, that most recent apogee surge marked the coming of the symbiont. And the future event that marks the permanent presence of the symbiont would be the wonderful vision and the wonderful appearance of Venus, Jupiter, and Mercury conjunct the Crab Nebula on the 28th of May, coming up then in about 23 days. So during the merry, merry month of May 2013, the symbiont arrives, and the whole world falls under the spell of the symbiont. It makes this an exceptionally wonderful summer for those of us in planetary tantra. This is the first great, full-blown, orgiastic summer of planetary tantra. Summer beginning, of course, on the 1st of May, on the 21st day of the cycle of Mirita at the hinge. These are the granular conditions that you can observe. And I want to stress to you once again, one of the primary lessons you are learning in the GNE is that human animals, with their goddess-given faculties, can observe granular details in the cosmos, granular details in nature, and granular details especially in the cosmic environment of the sky and the stars and the lunar cycles. And when you observe those granular details, and when you are present in that observation, right here, right now, interactive with what you observe, then you are in the magnification of the first attention that explodes into the power of the second attention. And so you actually lift yourself in a bootstrap fashion and load your own first attention into the dreaming attention of the goddess by the observation of these kinds of details. And there are many, many, many ways that you can do this in addition to the navigational framework that I am using. Now, someone asked me about the date, Monday the 13th of May, that I had mentioned previously. Well, yes, I did mention that in this respect. Not in His Image came out in Italian in February. It came out almost simultaneously with the resignation of the Pope and the lightning strike on the cupola of the Vatican, which was a V-form lightning strike, if you have seen the photograph. That was February. And at that time, in some of the anti-Vatican blogs, which are on the internet, people were talking about the third prophecy of Fatima. And in one of these anti-Vatican blogs, I read the claim that the third prophecy of Fatima named the date of May 13th, 2013, as the complete and total end of the Catholic Church and the regime of Roman Catholicism. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. And as you know, I don't care much for prophecy. But this is just intel. You know, we get things from many sources in the world. It's intel. And you have an informant. You can have an informant who says things about the Jesuits or about the Zionists or about the banking cartels or about black ops in the United States military. And sometimes this information is useful or instructive. So some informant has said that that date was indicated in the third and repressed prophecy of Fatima. And if it's true, then you can see why they repressed the third prophecy of Fatima until now. Anyway, it so happens that the next apogee surge is on Monday, May 13th. And I might say to you, that's about 8 days from now, I think. Where are we? We're on the 5th of May now. It's 1 week from now. And I might say, if you want to designate a specific date when the Gnostic moment begins? Well, that's the date. And why is that so? Because at that moment, the lunar apogee touches the feet of the twins and reaches a degree of the ecliptic, which would be 91 degrees of the ecliptic. That is 1 degree of the sign Cancer. Jupiter at that time is still advancing and catching up with the apogee. It is moving between the horns of the bull. So it's still in the bull, but the apogee moves officially, you might say, into the twins. And then on June 9th, in the next apogee surge, it's at 2 Cancer. And then on July 7th, it's again at 1 Cancer. This is 91 of the ecliptic. And then, on August 3rd, there is an apogee surge at 92 of the ecliptic, 2 Cancer. And then on August 30th, it's in 7, and on September 27th, it's in 12. So what do you see there? Well, a stall. As soon as the lunar apogee reaches the feet of the twins, it stalls. We've seen these stalls before. Remember, the lunar perigee toggles wildly, backward and forward. You know, when I first detected the movement of the lunar perigee, it reminded me of the way that dolphins move. You know, when dolphins are in their ecstasy of swimming and dancing and diving, a dolphin will leap out of the water and its body will torque and flip back and forth, and its tail will flip wildly from one side to the other. So the perigee of the moon behaves like the dolphin's tail, whereas the apogee of the moon behaves more like the dolphin's nose. That is to say, the head of the dolphin does not move back and forth. The head of the dolphin is relatively steady, although the lunar apogee does at certain times stall and drop back very slightly. In the GNE, we have already lived through two of these stalls. The third one is coming. So I would designate the moment from May 13th all the way through until about August 13th, that is June, July, and August, as the Gnostic moment, the focal intensity of the Gnostic moment is at that time, during that stall. Now you're going to see different mythological material coming across the bow of the mothership. You're going to see different kinds of archetypal and mythematic content flushing up out of the unconscious. And the general character of these themes and archetypes will fall into the image of the twins and the double, and the mysterious transactions of fate which are overseen by Idris. In the upcoming crew notes, I will include a summary of these apogee movements, okay? So you can print it out and look at it and refer to it and keep it side by side with a printout of the constellations so that you can visualize what I'm talking about. Now just let me add the second ingredient here, the critical ingredient. Remember that as the lunar apogee made its transition from the horns of the bull into the twins and then stall at the feet of the twins, Jupiter is coming up behind it, and now because the apogee stalls, well, Jupiter has a chance to catch up with it. And what do we have then? We have another converge. So there is not only a powerful, momentous event happening from May to August of this year, but there is a second converge, and that occurs in July, in the early part of July, when Jupiter actually passes into the feet of the twins itself. You won't be able to see this, by the way, because that's the summer and the sun is in that area. But you'll be able to imagine it, and you'll be able to make a drawing of it on the circular model of the zodiac that we use. So the converge of Jupiter and the lunar apogee occurs in July. And then, again, interestingly, in November, there is another converge followed by another stall. And that is the last converge of Jupiter and the Moon, and the last stall before the completion of the 3 years. And that is a big subject to be taken up later on. You know how the practice is. In the GNA, you follow things in real time. And so what we're in now is the moment of the Jupiter apogee, the Jupiter and lunar apogee converge at the foot of the twins. And we concentrate on that. Why would I designate this particular event and the stall to come to indicate the Gnostic moment? Well, you might recall some time back, I can't remember when it was, because I don't have written notes on what that would, you know, summarize or give a resume of the contents of any of these briefings, that I could riffle through the written notes and say, oh yes, I talked about this in that briefing, and I talked about this in another briefing. The download ratio combined with the delivery ratio are too rapid to allow me to compile such an inventory. If I were to stop and take the time to do that, it would decrease my ability to hold the download and delivery ratios at the level I'm holding them. So I can't really tell you where I said this, but I'm pretty sure that I spoke about the perihelion of Saturn. And I think I spoke about it in the context of my own natal chart and in my experiences with this gentleman named Willie Suker, who was an astrologer attached to the Anthroposophical Society, whom I met in Los Angeles at the Rudolf Steiner Research Center in August of 1976. Now, just want you to clear your minds for a moment. Put all the intel that I've given so far in this briefing aside. Put it on the back burner for a moment. And just sit back and picture in front of you a whiteboard, as if we were in a class. And the teacher is standing there, that's me, and I'm standing beside a whiteboard, okay? Vertical whiteboard. I draw a red circle in the center of this board with a symbol of a five-pointed star inside. That represents the sun. Then, using a black marker, I draw a circle around the sun quite close to it. That's the orbit of Mercury. I draw a circle a little bit larger. That's the orbit of Venus around the sun. Then, with a green marker, I draw a third circle, even larger. That's the orbit of the Earth around the sun. And once again, with a black marker, I draw a circle outside the Earth's orbit. That's the orbit of Mars. Then a bigger one, the orbit of Jupiter, and then a larger one, the orbit of Saturn. Now, take a look at that. What you see is a bullseye, is a kind of bullseye pattern. And what you're doing is actually looking at the heliocentric format of the solar system. Now, this is only a format. It doesn't mean that the solar system really looks like this. First of all, the solar system is not flat. Each of those circles is an ellipse. In reality, it's an ellipse. You know that, as the planetary orbits are not perfect circles, they're ellipses. And each of them is drawn into a screw line by the motion of the solar system through the sky. So the actual dynamic picture is quite different. But don't be concerned with that at this moment. We just use the format provisionally for what it can do for us. And it can serve very well in its own way. Looking at the drawing that I've just made, the bullseye pattern on the vertical whiteboard, you're actually as if you were looking down on the solar system. So the direction that each of the planets moves, each of the planets imagined as a little bead moving along these circles, they move counterclockwise. So in the first circle, close to the sun, a bead, small bead, is moving very rapidly, and that's Mercury. The next bead, moving less rapidly, is Venus. Then there's the Earth. They're all moving counterclockwise, okay? So you have the two planets between the Earth and the sun, Mercury and Venus. Then beyond the orbit of the Earth, moving more slowly still, is Mars, and then Jupiter, and then Saturn. That is the complete bullseye pattern. That is the heliocentric schema of the solar system. Vilisukar used these heliocentric schemas extensively and taught me how to use them. So when I did astrology and when I did research, historical research, with planetary cycles, I used the heliocentric schema as well as the geocentric schema. If you were to make a geocentric schema, you would simply draw another diagram, but it would have the Earth at the center rather than the sun. Okay? We're looking right now at the heliocentric schema of the solar system. And I've drawn this and asked you to imagine this in order to register in your mind one simple, singular, and supreme detail. Now, you know that each of these circular orbits is not really a perfect circle, that each of them is an oval or ellipse. Each of them is a flattened circle. And a flattened circle, therefore, has, like an egg, one end which is a little fatter and one end which is a little thinner. So when you set an egg on its end and try to make it stand up, you don't set it on the pointed end of the egg, do you? You set it on the fatter end of the egg. Well, likewise, these planetary orbits have a fat end and a pointed end. When you draw a line through the center of this geocentric schema and crossing these orbits, you therefore designate a line, you can designate a line that goes from the pointed end to the fatter end, and that is called the line of the apsides. So just as there are lunar apsides, which are called the apogee, meaning away from the Earth, and the perigee, meaning close to the Earth, you have in the heliocentric schema the apsides, which are called the aphelion, which is the point away from the sun, and the perihelion, which is the point nearest to the sun. So it's not perigee, because we're not talking about near to the Earth. It's perihelion, helios, near to the sun. So each of these, one, two, within the orbit of the Earth, three, the orbit of the Earth, four, five, six, orbits beyond the Earth. Each one of these six elliptical orbits that you see on the bullseye has a perihelion point and an aphelion point. And you can find those points in an astronomical reference book, and you can draw a line right through the center of the sun, and where it touches the orbit designates those two points. Now, what I learned, what Vilisukar taught me, was to how to investigate long patterns of time, events occurring over long patterns of time. No. To investigate historical patterns occurring over long periods of time. By the indications of these perihelia and aphelia. And this is the most remarkable study that now belongs to the method of Starbase. And that in itself is a tremendous topic. But for current purposes, to place the GNE, in the Gnostic moment, I just want you to consider one case, and that is the line that goes through the sun and extends out to the outermost circle. The largest circle is the orbit of Saturn. It defines the boundaries of the solar system. One point on the orbit of Saturn is its perihelion, closest to the sun, and the other point opposite is its aphelion, when Saturn is most distant from the sun. And this is called the apsides of Saturn. Where are the apsides of Saturn located in the constellations? Well, the perihelion of Saturn is located at 2 degrees of Cancer at the feet of the twins. And the aphelion is located opposite at 2 degrees of Capricorn, 272 on the ecliptic, which is close to the hand, close to the tip of the arrow of the archer, and about 5 degrees displaced from the galactic center. This is the visual location of these two points on the orbit of Saturn. Now, what I learned from Willy Sucker, and what I later extrapolated extensively beyond the framework in which he was working, because it was the Steinerite anthroposophical framework, and it was quite stultifying and had a huge bias in it in regard to its investigative and forensic capacities. So I took the clue or cue from Sucker and I ran with it. But I'll always remember one thing that Sucker told me. I remember, because he told me this while he was reading my prenatal and natal configurations in the heliocentric perspective. Because when Willy Sucker looked at a birth chart, he looked at the prenatal chart, that is a chart that is cast to reflect the planetary patterns roughly 9 months before you're born, 10 lunar months, and then the natal pattern at the moment of birth. And he compared them and he looked at what happened in the sky in the interval between the prenatal and natal moments. And there's a tremendous amount of information and data contained in the astronomical elements when you look at it in that way. And I remember that he pointed out to me that there were certain activities in the geocentric pattern which were then again replayed and extrapolated in my geocentric pattern, intimately connected with a point in the sky. And that point was the perihelion of Saturn, which is located at the feet of the twins. And that is exactly where the apogee of the moon is going to stall for 3 months. And that is exactly where Jupiter converges with the lunar apogee around the middle of July 2013. And as I was discussing this with Willy Sucker, he kindly informed me that according to his interpretation, the perihelion of Saturn represents the Gnostic impulse. It represents Gnosticism and the Sophianic wisdom of the human species. And by watching the way the perihelion of Saturn moves over long, long periods of time, and I'm talking about thousands of years, about millennia, you can actually make certain observations about the development of this impulse, as it might be called, the Gnostic impulse. And then you can go and look at history and see if these observations drawn from astronomical factors are supported by historical evidence, and you would be amazed at what happens when you do that. So that's what he got me to doing. That's what he was doing for a long time. And then he turned around and he applied those observations to individual cases, because he did read people's charts. And so he said to me, well, considering the activity of planets touching the perihelion of Saturn during the time of your gestation, I would say that you carry through into this world the power of that Gnostic movement. This is what he said to me in 1976. And I didn't know too much about Gnosticism at that time. I certainly hadn't even read the Nag Hammadi texts. In fact, I think that's the year they came out, wasn't it? In English? 76? So, Gnosticism, I knew, I had the term in my mind, but I didn't have any particular intel on it, and I didn't have any notion of a Sophianic wisdom legacy that belongs to humanity. I didn't know about the Teleste or the Telestic method. I didn't know what I know today about the operations of the mystery schools. I didn't know, for instance, that the Gnostics were the great educators and teachers of the human race. Didn't know any of that. But Willy Suka lays this on me. Oh, well, it looks like you have a pickup. That's the term that I devised for this. There's a pickup. I had a pickup, reincarnational pickup, if you will. Okay. And a reincarnational pickup on the perihelion of Saturn. Bingo. And now, as the lunar apogee reaches that same point, followed by the convergence of Jupiter, which represents the Terma of Gaia awakening. Remember, Jupiter is the guru. The Terma is the guru. I'm not the guru. Combined with that converge with Jupiter, what do you think we got? It's the Gnostic moment. It's the moment of the return of the repressed. It's the moment when humanity has the option, I'm just saying the option, to draw massively upon what Philip K. Dick called the disinhibiting instructions of Gnosis. The disinhibiting instructions of Gnosis. And this is the moment, if there is any moment when it could happen, when planetary tantra goes wide, when it breaks wide. Now, I'm not going to say it goes mainstream, but I'm going to say it breaks wide in the world at this moment. This is the Gnostic moment. The Gnostic moment is an opportunity for humanity in this setting of history, in this historical moment, and in this cultural and collective crisis moment, when humanity has the option to recognize what Gnosticism really is. And it is for us who are already inside the Gnostic movement, who are the transmitters and agents of the Gnostic movement, it is the moment for us to acquire a supreme confidence about what we know. Jupiter is confidence. And no matter what happens, and no matter how it breaks wide, the crucial thing is that those of us who are inside that impulse know that that recognition is invincible. And the recognition of the Gnostic Sophianic legacy of humanity cannot be defeated. That is our Gnostic moment. It's the moment of your ultimate confidence along with me that the power of the wisdom goddess in her magical animals can never be defeated and never ultimately be destroyed, and it cannot even be repressed. because every time that it has been repressed, it has bounced back. And come to think of it, I might say that I almost feel like I might have written something prophetic in the last chapter of Not in His Image, which is called The Pagan Sense of Life. What comes back with the symbiont and the return of the great god Pan is the pagan sense of life. Is it possible that the pagan sense of life would break out all over the place on this planet, simultaneously with the massive dystrophic breakdown of culture? Well, why not? Why not? Let's be observant. Let's see. In the last chapter of Not in His Image, which you might want to reread, I wrote about those moments in history when the pagan sense of life resurged, native resurgence. And I explained what massive assaults and genocidal campaigns were required to repress it. And I speculated somewhere in here that with regard to the deep-seated soul sickness of Western civilization, the bad news turns out to be the good news. Knowing how we are deviated could be the very truth, the deeper education we so resist, that leads us to participate in Sophia's correction. It could be the knowledge that saves global society from its dominant pathological affliction, perpetrator religion. The legacy of divine paternalism is 100 generations of bad parenting and abuse. That is a lot of dysfunctionality to overcome. But the enlightenment of the last 30 years looks extremely promising. And so I suppose, or I propose, that viewing the resurgence of the Gnostic impulse indicated by the perihelion of Saturn and the resurgence of the Sophianic wisdom throughout European history, we can only wonder, as I wondered here in the last chapter of Not in His Image, where you can find this sentence, quote, "One wonders if the native genius of Europe has enough immunity to resist the conqueror virus and resurge yet again, perhaps one last time," end quote. Of course, that question does not merely apply to the native genius of Europe, but it implies to the indigenous genius of the anthropos all over this planet. Nevertheless, Europe, where I now stand, was the place from which the perpetrator virus spread to the world at large. This region of Andalusia was the place that saw the last confrontation, historically, between Europeans and the carriers of the salvationist virus in the form of Islam. In fact, down in Tarifa, which is a little port town about 40 miles from here, it is the southernmost tip of continental Europe, there is a statue erected to Guzman el Bueno, who was the Spanish warrior who drove the wave of Islam out of Spain and back into Africa. And it's interesting that that hero in Spanish history, who returned Andalusia to the native people of Iberia, died in the town nearby where I live. So I am close to the roots of these European events, and I speak as an American whose life is dedicated to the rebirth of the indigenous spirit of Europe. I would expect that if there is to be a Gnostic revival on this planet, it would begin here and spread from here. The place, ideally, that the Gnostic revival should spread from, if it were to occur on this planet, is, guess where? Syria. Do you know, there is something horrible happening in Syria today, as you know. I won't go into the politics. But I was listening to this internet commentator named Syrian Girl. And she's become quite a well-known voice on the internet now, on the alternative internet, because she appears to be a Syrian, not living in Syria, but someone who's challenging the false narrative about what's happening in Syria. In many respects, I would say that the whole fate, the historical fate of Western civilization, depends right now on what's happening in Syria. And isn't that interesting? Because Syria is in fact the homeland of the Levantine mysteries and the location where the Sophianic vision story of the Telestai was most preciously preserved. And I was listening to a comment by Syrian Girl about Syria, in which she said, there's a saying in Syria, and it goes like this. Everyone has two homes. One of them is the place you are born, and the other is Syria. Now, that's a really interesting saying. I wonder where that came from. Now, I'm not in Syria, and I'm not getting involved in any Middle Eastern affairs, you can be sure of that. But I feel the crucial and critical nature of what is happening there, and how the fraudulent narrative of the New World Order predators depends on taking Syria down as the next stage in toppling the Middle East so that it can become a Zionist kingdom. But I stand in Europe, and I feel the land of Europe beneath my feet, and I feel the anguish and the chagrin and grief of the European people at this time. And so I am watching to see how the Gnostic moment transpires from my outpost in Europe. And I ask you to watch from your outposts, wherever you may be, in New Zealand, South Africa, the United States, Canada, New Mexico, Arizona, New York, in Germany, in Serbia, in the Netherlands, in France, in Scotland, England, in Wales, in Spain, in Italy, in South America, in Argentina, Brazil. I ask you all to watch how the Gnostic moment reveals itself where you are. And bear in mind that this astronomical intel is in of itself of no importance. But it is a tool that you can use and then discard it once you've used it. But I urge you to use this tool. I urge you to follow the parameters I offer, because with this tool, you locate yourself in your own power, and you locate yourself in the Sophianic vision on the interface with the crisis of our time. Sophianic vision has an historical aspect. You can believe that, and I have only just begun to say what it is and to lay it out. Nothing can change the narrative on this planet as much as the resurgence of the Gnostic impulse and the Sophianic vision of life. And how that might happen and how it will happen is to be revealed now, right now, in the Gnostic moment that is now dawning, as surely as the sun is dawning. Right now, outside this house, dawning behind the hills to the southeast in the Reed Valley of Andalusia.